Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU scientist the...
I
figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, welcome to The Story Clutter, where true personal stories about science help us to discover how weird and wonderful it is to exist in this world and be a human. I'm your host, Misha Gajewski, and we're settled into the new year, so we're all warmed up and it's time to go there. Science versus faith. The ultimate showdown where spiritual and the empirical collide. Okay, that's way overstating it, but we know there's this imagined tension between faith and science. In this episode, we're going to meet people who are navigating this terrain and showing us that reason and faith aren't opposites. They really complement each other. Up first is John Fugelsang. John is a New York-based all-around media guy and someone of real faith. His ability to bring his faith to his Twitter feed is amazing. These days, you can find him as the host of Tell Me Everything on Sirius XM Insight channel. His story was recorded at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York last year. And best of all, it's hilarious. Here's John.
I'm not supposed to be here because of religion, but I get to be here because of science. And I will explain. I come from a Catholic background, an extremely Catholic background. We used to have open casket reunions. And this story happened during the worst year of my life. My network series had gone off the air. I was living in LA. I was broke. I was deeply depressed. And worst of all, my parents retired to Florida. Now, I don't know if you've had the pleasure. When my parents told me they were considering going down there, I begged them. I said, you can't retire, please. Don't you know? Moving to Florida is one of the steps in Kubler-Ross's stages of death and dying. It's between bargaining and denial is move to Florida and get the white shoes and leave your turn signal on in Jeb country. I came to regret the joke because my father had his second heart attack, the big heart attack, while mowing the lawn in Florida a week before he turned 70. Now, this is a couple of weeks later, it's Thanksgiving night. My dad has gone to bed. We're in the house in Florida. My mother has stayed up to tell my girlfriend and me how dire his health situation is because he had had 6 bypasses. And you cannot get a heart transplant over 70 unless your last name is Cheney in this country. She said to me, the pacemaker will help him with his pain. The nitroglycerin patches I apply in the morning and evening will help him with his pain. But because of his age, because of the bypasses, he is not a candidate for any available treatments. I said, okay, Mom, how can I help? What can I do? She goes, I don't need you to do anything. I would like to ask you both one question, though. How would your life change if you two just right now went and got married? I said, okay, Mom, that's not going to happen, but can you understand how what you just did is an example of what we call emotional blackmail? And she replied, it's not emotional blackmail. It's nothing of the kind. I'm just offering up an innocent hypothetical because your father's dying in the next room. Now, for me, this was rough. Let me explain how Catholic guilt works because it's often misunderstood. It's nothing like Jewish guilt. If you feel bad about something you did, that's guilt. And that can be good. If you feel bad about who you are as a person, that's shame. But if you feel shame because you believe God wants you to feel more guilt, that's Catholic. That's the gift that keeps on giving. And it's such a big gift, I got to see somebody 2 times a week to learn how to unwrap it. I said, Mom, I'm sorry, I love you, but I can't get married to please my parents. That's what gay Republicans do. My mother would not be daunted. She said to me, look, why can't you just do it? And I said, Mom, I'm broke. I haven't worked in a year. I lost my health insurance and I had to go off the antidepressants cold turkey. You have no idea what that does to you. And I'm selling all my old DVDs and CDs in LA right now for food money. It's not the right time to have my happy day. She said, how would it change your life? I said, it wouldn't change my life at all, Mom. I'd still be like this. I'm not going to go and get married and have a wedding that I don't want and that she doesn't want and that we don't believe in Florida. And she said again, how would it change your life? I said, it wouldn't change it at all. I'd be like this. I'd be miserable on my wedding day. And she said, well, if you're going to be miserable anyway, you may as well be married. Now, look, she said, he's going. It's not a question of how, it's a question of when. It could be weeks, it could be months. I'm asking you to set a date. Just set a date. Just give my husband something to stay alive for. I should also mention now that my mother was a registered nurse, a person of science, and she was also a former nun. My mother grew up in the segregated South, and when she finished high school, she went straight into the convent. And I could never understand why. I could never understand what would possess a young girl right out of high school to take a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience. But she did it right after the prom. The convent put her through nursing school, and they briefly sent her to work in a hospital here in Brooklyn before shipping her overseas to Africa to work with lepers in the jungles of Malawi. My father was a Franciscan brother, born right here, and he wore the brown robes and the rope belt, and he talked history to Catholic boys, and he walked amongst the people like the lost Jedi of Flatbush. My father, the brother, met my mother, the sister. When he was hospitalized with tuberculosis and was briefly her patient. Now, he had sworn, like the Jedi, to never know love, but by all accounts I have ever heard, he fell instantly, desperately, hopelessly, passionately over the edge and never coming back in love. First sight with this quiet Southern girl in a nun's habit that he knew he could never have, and it promised his God he would never want. They became friends. They could be nothing more. And when the convent shipped her over to Africa, he wrote her letters every week, just friendly letters telling her about what was going on back in the States, LBJ and civil rights and his hero, Martin Luther King, in the Vietnam War. My mother's village had no TVs, no radios, so his letters became the de facto newspapers for the convent. The Mother Superior would open her mail, read the letters out loud to everyone, and my mother was always the last one to receive them. It took her many years to call it a cult, but she got there. She got there. Now, at one point, she wrote to my father after several years and said that she was going to come back briefly to the States. My dad casually said to his supervisor that he was thinking about maybe one day leaving the brothers. And without asking any questions, his supervisor said, whoever she is, if you love her, marry her. He borrowed a car and made the drive 8 hours down south to Virginia Beach, found the hospital where she was working an overnight shift, sat at her desk, talked with her until the sun came up, and then told her he loved her. And she threw him out of the hospital, saying, you have no right. Do you see how I'm dressed? Do you see the habit I'm wearing? You have no right to say such a thing to me. But he had done it. He had broken his vow. And the next day, she invited him over to meet her family. My Southern grandmother was horrified. A Yankee from Brooklyn? I won't be able to understand a word he says. But my dad showed up in his clerical collar, all New York charm. And when he was done, he kissed my grandmother on the cheek. He kissed my mother's sisters on the cheek, turned to my mother, and politely shook her hand. And that's how the Southern ladies knew the Yankee was in love. My mother went back to Africa, but he had gotten through to her, and she left. She left the convent, They married on a tiny army base in Virginia. It was a first love and a second marriage for them both. And they settled in the Isle of Long and tried to raise me and my brothers to be progressive, free-thinking Catholics, which is why I do stand-up, because I can't afford the therapy I actually require. So I grew up admiring Jesus the way anybody admires mom's first husband, but... I've come to believe, and I mean no disrespect to any faithful scientists here, I've come to view Jesus the way I view Elvis. I love the guy, but the fan clubs horrify me. My mother taught me that there was no disassociation, nothing in conflict between science and the teachings of Jesus. And my father taught me that Jesus was a peaceful, radical, nonviolent revolutionary who hung around with lepers, hookers, and criminals, who never spoke English, was not an American citizen, was anti-wealth, completely anti-death penalty, anti-public prayer. He was, motherfucker, Matthew 6:5, anti-public prayer, never once anti-gay, never once mentioned abortion, never once technically came out against premarital sex, never called poor people lazy, never fought for tax cuts for the wealthiest Nazarenes, never asked a leper for a copay, never said torture's okay sometimes, and was a long-haired, brown-skinned, that's in Revelation, fuck you Left Behind books, brown-skinned, homeless, community organizing, unarmed, anti-slut-shaming, Palestinian liberal Jew. That is, of course, only if that's what you believe what's in the Bible. So when I was six, my grandmother down south showed me some family photos, and I saw my mother in a habit and realized for the first time what she had been. I realized why my parents were so much older than the other parents. And when I was 11, I learned what a vow of celibacy was. And that began my entire teenage existential crisis, which continues to this day, of knowing I'm not supposed to be here. And now... this man is dying in this room. And this woman is telling me that I have to marry my girlfriend to give her husband something to stay alive for. And there's no way it can happen. And I tell her, I would love to, but just as you didn't marry for religious reasons, we vowed never to marry for bohemian reasons. And that was good enough. She said, do you not believe in marriage? Is that it? You just don't believe in it? I said, no, Mom, marriage is great. I think a wedding is the most beautiful gift you can ever give your parents' friends. So I appealed to her on the basis of science. I tried to use science to convince her. I said, Mom, you do realize that monogamy is not natural in humans, right? I mean, most mammals mate for one or two seasons and then move on. Charlie Sheen. There's only six species of mammals that biologically mate naturally for life. Foxes, wolves, elephant shrews, beavers, gibbons, and the dick. Only Homo sapiens choose to mate against their nature and then go through all manner of guilt and torment when that's hard to pull off. So it's beautiful, Mom. It's spiritual. It's just not natural. And then she brought up that my girlfriend and I had been together for 11 years already. And that's true. We had been together a very long time. We were the happy couple that wasn't married, that still partied. Everyone hated us at the weddings. You know that fucking couple that didn't get married and they're still in love and they're insufferable. Yeah. So, to be honest, I didn't want to get married, but I did want my father at my wedding. I was raised with science and religion. I have learned to live with contradiction. On the day I got married, my father was not able to stand for the entire service, but he was there. I asked him to be my best man. He was the reason I was doing it. And he hadn't been in front of a classroom in years, but in a very frail state, he held forth before our guests and talked buoyantly, joyfully, to be in front of people again, to be in front of a crowd again, as he merrily told them humiliating stories of my childhood and adolescence. And you know, it's kind of funny to rush into a marriage after 11 years of courtship. We couldn't find any place that would marry us really, really fast, like really, really fast. But my girlfriend's parents lived in Gainesville, about an hour away from mine. They found a little meditation center on a lake. My mother liked this because she could call it a chapel. And I just figured, well, Tom Petty's born in Gainesville. That's something. That was literally how I talked myself through it. Tom Petty was born here. The only date we could find to get married in under 3 months was on a Sunday, Oscar night, February 29, because nobody wanted to get married on leap day. We thought it was perfect. We'd still be married, but we'd only have to acknowledge it every presidential election cycle. So after the wedding was done, my father was drained, but he made up his mind that he wasn't ready to go yet, and he would do anything possible to have more time with the woman he loved that he had found. And my parents saw a segment on 2020 about an experimental stem cell treatment for heart patients in Bangkok, Thailand. Don Ho did it, my mother told me. And I said, no, can't you see this is snake oil, Mom? Can't you see this is a racket? This is just designed to ensnare terrified old people. Please let him go with dignity. And she replied, are we to sit around and wait to die? They pooled any inheritance I could have hoped for, and my mother pushed my father to Thailand in his new wheelchair. He could no longer walk. The Thai doctors did many tests and drew his blood. They shipped it to Israel. The Israeli doctors harvested his own stem cells from his blood and shipped them back to Thailand. Then the Thai doctors implanted these stem cells on his heart in the hopes that they might somehow grow new arteries. And so it was that my Catholic father put his faith in the Buddhists and the Jews. And so it was that within 2 months, he ditched the wheelchair and could walk 2 miles a day and got to go back to working in his yard and got to meet his first grandchild and got to take my mother on their first ever cruise. And I still have to be married. He lived 5 years longer than any doctor said he could live. And on the first Father's Day after he left us, my wife and I conceived our child. And that kid gets to grow up in this beautiful, fucked up world because some guy from Brooklyn long ago chose love over religion. So I am extremely grateful to everyone at Story Collider. I'm extremely grateful to my parents. I'm extremely grateful to a group of doctors far away who I will never meet. And I'm extremely grateful to stem cell science for giving me the metaphor I didn't know I needed and will always carry with me and hold to the belief, what I learned, that sometimes what you need to heal your heart is already inside you.
That was John Fugelsang. To learn more about him, visit our website, storyclatter.org. Being a storyteller on our stage is just one way to make Story Clatter happen, but if standing alone in the spotlight in front of an audience doesn't speak to you, maybe becoming a Story Clatter donor is more your speed. Story Clatter donors play a vital role in our ability to bring you this podcast. We're in this together. Story Clatter is one big experiment that's designed to connect us around our love of discovery, curiosity, and the natural world. If you believe in the power these stories have and this mission, please donate to the Story Clatter at storyclatter.org/donate. The most popular level is $10 a month, and you can make your tax-deductible donation at storyclatter.org/donate. But really, any level makes a difference, and we're so grateful to everyone who supports us.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Our next story is from storyteller Chris Mustafa Gray. His story is all about the delicate balance all parents need to strike when raising a child in a multi-faith household. It's so good. I can't wait for you to hear it. Here's Chris.
So one day, I was out on one of my many walks. You know, we did a lot of that during COVID because you couldn't go anywhere, go walking. And I came home and my wife was sitting in my office and she looked mad. For those of y'all who are married, have got significant others, you can tell when you walk in a room that your significant other, like something's wrong just by the look on their face. And so I instantly went through the inventory of everything I did in the past 24 hours. And I was like, yeah, or didn't do. And I was like, okay, did I leave dishes in the sink? No. Did I leave the toilet seat up? No. And I was like, I think I'm good. Whoever she's mad at, it's not me. I think I'm clean. And so she's sitting in my work chair, my desk chair, and she turned around like a Bond villain, right? And in her hand, she was holding a copy of the Quran. Yeah, a Quran that I had hidden from her in my office. And she was mad. Like she was holding it like she had just found a pair of woman's panties in our bedroom. Like she looked hurt and betrayed. And she was just like, I don't even know who you are anymore. I was like, what? You don't know me. And then she said the most preposterous thing. I don't even know if you believe in science. And I was like, oh. So let me take you back just a moment. When we got together, 10 years prior, one of the things we bonded over was our mutual rejection of organized religion. So, you know, she had some bad experiences with the evangelical church. I just grew up black in America. So we were just like, all right, cool. You know, so religion wasn't part of our lives. But then our daughter was born. And I feel crazy even saying this to anybody, but I had a very spiritual experience, like the moment my daughter was born. So I was holding her. And I remember I picked her up and her little eyes just barely opened. And I looked in her eyes and I just mumbled. I was like, where did you come from? And instantly I saw this vision, tunnel of light. And it was going back in time, like through my family. I saw my parents. I saw my grandparents, my great grandparents, like just going on back all the way back through our lineage. And like, I've never seen photos of these people. I don't know what they look like, but each person, I saw their face clearly. I saw their clothing styles, you know, regress back in time. And I knew who each one was. And it went all the way back to like our West African ancestors. And I saw them. Each one was holding a child just like I was. And it was the next person in that line. And so it was like one of the most profound experiences I've ever had. And it lasted only a moment. Just like you hear when people have those near-death experiences and their whole life flashes before their eyes, it was just that quick. So shortly after that, I returned to my faith and belief that I had been brought up with. And I didn't, knowing how anti-religious my wife was, I didn't tell her. I just kept it to myself, you know, and I just practiced on my own. When I'd have like my 5 daily prayers, I told her I was doing yoga and like meditating. I stopped drinking. I stopped smoking weed. I stopped eating pork. And I told her it was because my doctor said I had high blood pressure. And so for 2 years, she thought I was on this journey of self-care. But now she was holding the Quran and she knew. She was like, oh, this just isn't about self-care. You actually believe in God, don't you? And it's a weird argument to try and defend yourself against, you know? Because I'm just like, nothing has changed in the past 2 years. She's like, I thought you were getting better for me. I was like, nah, man. But so she kind of came to grips with it and she put on the condition that she's like, I was not allowed to indoctrinate our daughter into my religion. And I was fine. I was like, cool. This is my personal walk. No, I'm not. I don't make no requirements of anybody else, especially our daughter. You know, I was like this, you know, that's how I was raised. You just, you know, you do you. So one of the requirements we had was anytime our daughter asked me about, you know, anything, you know, religious or spiritual, anything like that, I always have to preface it with, well, some people believe that. And then I can give her the explanation, because the magical thing about kids is they're little believers. They believe in what they see and in what they can imagine. And they meld the two in their little minds. So my daughter, you know, she believes in what she learns in school, what she observes, but then she also believes in fairies and witches and, you know, all kind of magic and things like that. So as she grows, you know, kids, they're curious. They're always asking, like, what is that? What are you doing? And, you know, you explain. And then they go into the next question. Why? Why are you doing that? Why does that happen? Why? And I would explain to her, but then when it got anywhere close to something religious, spiritual, anything like that, I'd say, well, some people believe that. And then I would explain it to her. So this continued as my daughter's growing. And it's awesome watching kids like meld these two things in their mind. Cause my daughter's, she's a little deep thinker. So one day she asked me, Dad, is Santa Claus real? And I was like, well, some people believe that Santa Claus is real. Some people believe Santa Claus isn't real. And she said, what do you believe? And oh, this is a defining moment. Because all of us who are parents, like, you want your kids to hold on to that magic of when they're kids and things like that, but you don't want your kid to be the first kid to not believe in Santa Claus, but you also want them not to be the last kid to not believe. You want them to be like somewhere right in the middle. And I didn't know where she fell in her class yet. I was like, I don't want you going on ruining it for everybody. So I said, well, I don't want to lie to you, because I don't want that to backfire too. Come back when she's 16, like, you lied to me about it. And like, nope. So I said, listen, I don't believe that Santa Claus is real. And so she was like, all right. And she walked away, and I for 24 hours, I was like, oh my gosh. That's it. I've ruined it. This is the moment. There's no more magic for her. And then she came back the next day. She says, Dad, Santa Claus is real. And here's why. And she whipped out a list. Number one, he always brings me what I want. Number two, he ate the cookies I left out for him. Number three, I've checked with all my friends and he brings them exactly what they want. And number four, he also eats the cookies at their houses. And number five, my favorite, she's pretty sure she found some reindeer tracks in the front yard that to me look suspiciously like a golden retriever's paw print. And I said, all right, and that's it. I was like, I'm not arguing with you. You've presented me your evidence. You've given your hypothesis, and here's your theories, your evidence. You backed it up with research. I bow to you. Whatever your belief is, we'll go with that. So I'm like, cool. She's a little scientist. She'll come back, or a lawyer. You know, you start thinking as a parent, what's she gonna be? But I was just very proud of her. She basically used kind of the scientific method to prove me wrong. And I was like, okay. But then this continues as she grows up, and she just makes these, grows up. She's seven now, but grows up. But this continues, like, she's just a very deep thinker. She would just make these observations and these connections. Like one day she said, Dad, that's not the real sky. She was four. And we're looking at the clouds and, you know, I'm like, you know, planes flying over the Atlanta airport. And I was like, what do you mean that's not the real sky? And she said, the night that's the real sky. And I was like, yo! Like, we're on a rock spinning through space. Yes, the night, that is space. That is the real sky. At four, she said that. I didn't grasp that concept till high school. Like, she, one day we're watching Buzz Lightyear. And I don't know if any of you have seen the movie, but in the movie, like, Buzz Lightyear, he's trying to go the speed of light. In the beginning of the movie, he keeps taking these test flights, trying to go the speed of light. And he's staying young while everybody else on Earth is getting older. And my daughter asked, like, why is everybody getting old? And so I gave her like a kid's version of Einstein's theory of relativity, where I said, some people believe, because it is a theory, people. So we're gonna stick to the rule. So I was like, some people believe that, you know, if we could go the speed of light or approach it, the time would slow down for the traveler, and everybody else, they would stay young, everybody would get older. And I said, if we ever achieve the speed of light, time would stop for the traveler. And if you ever exceed the speed of light, it's like a time machine and you would go back in time. And she was just like, whoa. And then she said, Dad, angels are made of light. And I was like, yeah. And she said, so time for them doesn't matter. They can be anywhere, anytime, all the time. Again, and I looked over at my wife and she was looking at me like, angels? And I was like, listen, I didn't say nothing. This is all coming from her. And like, as she's like making these connections, like my faith in her of like, yeah, this kid, she's got a brain. She's thinking. She's just not going to take what me or anybody else just tells her. She's going to think it through. She's just not going to be a blind follower. I like that. It's annoying, but I like that. So one of my favorite scientific theories in physics is called the observer effect. And it basically says in a nutshell that by observing a phenomenon, you can affect that phenomenon and change it. So for example, to observe an electron, a photon of light has to interact with that electron for you to even see it. Thus, that interaction causes the electron to change its path of travel. So if you, just by you observing it, you've changed it. So just by, you know, me interacting with my daughter, like she's changing like me. She's like encouraging me. Like, I'm like, yeah, like she's sinking these things of like my beliefs of what I've told her, other belief systems, which we've taught her in her natural world. And she's like putting it all together and she's watching, she's observing. So I have this practice where I used to work downtown. And if you've ever been downtown, you know, there's a lot of people in need, a lot of homeless people. So like every time I was downtown, you know, people would ask you for money. They ask you for change. And so I would always do that thing where you pat your pockets and just go, oh, no, I don't have anything. And so I kept doing that so much where I finally started just carrying some cash on me so that people, you know, if I was asked, I could help get, you know, and help them give them something. And this was just like my own little thing to feel good. You know, it's just like, I'm helping out. Didn't really advertise it, didn't tell anybody about it, but my daughter's been watching. So one day we're driving and on the off ramp, you see someone holding a sign and she's like, Dad, we've got to help that guy. Give me some money. We got to help him. Now this time I didn't have any cash on me. And so I was like, I don't have any money. And like the look on her face, she just looked so disappointed, like I had let her down. And I immediately drove to an ATM machine and withdrew money, drove back to get on the interstate to go the opposite direction. So, and then got off so we could come back and get to that same off ramp where that guy was holding his sign so she could roll down the window and give him that money. And so just like the observer effect, like just the fact that she's observing me, I have to uphold what I say I believe in. I have to actually live it. I can't just give it lip service and say, oh yeah, this is dad, there's things we should do. You know, we should help people. We should, you know, give when we can, but she's watching. And I feel like, you know, kids, if that, that look of disappointment, I didn't want her to think like, you know, you're just full of shit. So like the observer effect, the fact that she's observing me continues to change my behavior, my direction, so that I feel that I'm moving in a right path because I'm being a good example to her. And so the more I've thought about it is just as long as I continue to do that in my life, I don't have to tell anybody about what I believe, what my faith is, what my faith practices are, any of that. All I have to do is just live it, embody it, and try being a good example of it. So one day my daughter, and this was actually rather recently, we were out somewhere. And so she asked me, she said, Dad, I think God is like the wind. My wife instantly looked at me and I'm like, I don't know where this is going. And she said, well, I can't see the wind, but I know it's there because I can feel it. I can see the trees moving in it and I can see the birds flying in it. And I said, you know, again, kid, you're blowing my mind. And so she said, is that what you believe? That God is around us and but we can't see him. It's just, but we can see what he affects. And I said, yes, that is what I believe. And she said, I think I believe it too.
Chris Mustafa Gray, my friends, told you his story was great. If you'd like to learn more about him, visit our website, storyclutter.org. Our website is just one way to connect with Story Clutter, but there are so many other ways, and we hope you'll use all of them. You can always follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Head to storyclutter.org to become a financial supporter, or if you want to come to one of our shows or want to start your own Story Clutter show in your community, you can learn all about that on our website, too. This podcast is produced by me, Misha Gajewski, along with Nikisha Roberts-Washington, Jen Chen, and Aaron Barker, Executive Director and Co-Founder of The Story Collider. The stories featured in today's episode were produced by Aaron Barker, Mesa Saleta, and Emma Yarbrough. Special thanks goes out to The Story Collider's board and staff, including Anne-Marie Lonsdale, Leslie Burnson, and Lindsay Cooper. Our theme music is by Ghost, and next week, I'll be back with stories of postpartum depression. Until next time, thanks so much for listening.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.